Senator Stevens' defense team begins arguing his case. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 9th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a controversial way to catch illegal hunting near Bethel.
Those are exactly the kind of people that need to be caught. They weren't trying to catch meat, they just shoot at it. They kill it just to kill it. That's totally against everything, all the respect and the teachings of what I've heard.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and October, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com.
The government rested its case today against Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, who was accused of lying about gifts on his financial disclosure forms. Now it's the defense attorney's turn to make their case to jurors. They started today with an impressive character witness and began poking holes in the prosecution's case. APRN's Libby Casey is covering the Stevens trial and joins us from Washington. Hi, Libby.
Good evening, Lori.
Libby, did the defense try to make a big start with their first witness?
Yes. They called Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii. He and Stevens have a 40-year friendship, despite belonging to different political parties, and they're also bonded by their experience as veterans of World War II. Inouye said they're so close, Stevens' daughter calls him Uncle Dan. He said Stevens' word is good enough to take to the bank, and said his reputation for truth and integrity is absolute. A prosecutor did ask him about the Senate financial forms, the ones that Stevens is accused of misreporting on, and pointed out that Inouye signs his forms himself by hand, trying to emphasize the importance of this paperwork, but Inouye wouldn't be led off his purpose to show he believes Stevens to be honest and trustworthy.
Well, how important do you think character witnesses will be to the defense?
Very important. They went to call 10 people. The judge will probably limit that number because it gets redundant. But on the list for tomorrow is former Secretary of State Colin Powell.
And Libby, how did the defense start chipping away at the case against Stevens today?
Well, they tackled one of the disputed gifts, a sled dog given to Stevens in 2003 by a friend. Three Alaskans testified about this dog today. Two mushers, Dean Osmar of Clam Gulch, who raised the dog, and David Monson of Fairbanks, husband of the late Susan Butcher. Monson and Butcher ended up with the dog when Stevens realized it wasn't cut out for Washington city life, and in fact, Stevens paid them to take it. Well, prosecutors say the dog was bought at a charity auction for $1,000 as a gift for Stevens. He did claim it on his financial form that said it was worth only a quarter of that price. However, today its breeder says the dog was a runt and probably not cut out for mushing and was really only worth $50 to $100. And the courtroom seemed to think it was a big novelty to hear about Alaskan sled dogs and hear from the mushers and Alaskan singer Hobo Jim, who gave the dog to the charity auction. And there were a lot more smiles from Senator Stevens today, who was laughing at some of the things the witnesses said and reacting instead of just sort of sitting stony-faced. One detail the prosecutors pointed out yesterday, though, was that while Stevens was filling out his financial form, he wrote emails to the friend who gave him the dog and said, look, I can't really say on these forms, a friend gave this to me. Why don't we say it's a gift from the nonprofit charity that hosted the auction, the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association? Well, prosecutors made a big deal out of that yesterday.
The prosecution has rested its case today, but they suffered a major setback last night. How is that shaking out?
Yeah, Judge Emmett Sullivan accused prosecutors of lying about evidence yesterday and said two matters will have to be struck from the record, a vehicle swap between Stevens and Vico CEO Bill Allen, and Vico paperwork itemizing the hours two employees spent working on Stevens' Girdwood home renovation. The jury knew nothing about all of this until today. These intense legal conversations happen when the jury's not in the courtroom. But this afternoon, the judge clued them in. He read them a statement saying that the government had an obligation to provide information to the defense and did not do so. As a result, some of the evidence is out.
How did the prosecution react to that?
They asked to call one last witness today, Vigo employee Dave Anderson, who's also the nephew of Bill Allen. His timesheets are out as evidence, so they called him to go through, in his own words, how much time he spent working on Stephen's house. And he testified that starting in the summer of 2000, he was there most weeks, 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. He went step by step through the renovation process and said while contractors were hired on the books by Stevens for some projects, Anderson and his fellow LECO workers were there doing everything from supervising to pounding nails. And he talked about buying things for the house with LECO purchase orders and making things at the LECO shop.
Libby, now that the prosecution has rested its case, do you have a sense of how well it all came together?
You know, yes, but of course we have to wait and see how much the defense manages to chip away at it. Prosecutors kept beating the drum of Stevens knew about gifts, he never paid for them, end of story. And yesterday they showed lots of emails and letters, which were really interesting because Stevens and his lawyers say his wife was in charge of the house, what they call the teepee. But in the emails, Stevens is regularly hearing from friends about the progress of the renovation. He forwards the emails to his wife. And while she might make decisions about the floor type or the paint color, Stevens does appear to be in the loop. And in the emails, he comments about what a great job some of the workers are doing, LECO workers. Prosecutors say that shows his awareness that LECO's handprint was all over the renovation.
All right. Thanks, Libby, for that update.
Thank you, Lori.
APRN's Washington correspondent, Libby Casey, is covering the Stevens trial. The Alaska Supreme Court this afternoon refused to block the legislature from releasing the results of an investigation into the firing of Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The Supreme Court has upheld the ruling by an Anchorage Superior Court that dismissed the complaint by six legislators who wanted to stop the investigation into Monaghan's firing. The lawmakers, Wes Keller, Fred Dyson, Carl Gatto, Mike Kelly, Tom Wagner, and Bob Lynn, said the Legislative Council, through the Senate Judiciary Committee, was conducting an unconstitutional investigation while violating its own internal rules as well as ignoring legal precedent. In presenting arguments before the Supreme Court, the Legislative Council's attorney said the checks and balances established within the Constitution encourages the legislature to investigate the executive branch. It's among its inherent powers to act as a watchdog of government, he said. The Superior Court decision delivered a week ago and upheld today by this decision found that the legislature must determine its own rules and procedures. And it found the legislative investigation did not violate common standards available to all citizens as outlined in the Constitution. The investigation itself is completed and will be available to lawmakers and then the public at a meeting scheduled for tomorrow morning. I'm Dave Donaldson in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, John Little's dog team struggles to come back from a devastating accident.
I'm really not negative when it comes to the dogs, and I still have a really good dog team. It's just a lot thinner.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The 8th Annual Aviation North Expo is happening at the Fairbanks Princess Riverside Lodge October 16th through the 18th. This three-day aviation conference features travel and lodging discounts, FAA certification, a trade show, and networking opportunities. For details and to register, visit aviationnorth.org or call toll-free 877-427-5599. This message sponsored by the Aviation North Expo.
Two men from the village of Tuliksak are being charged with taking a moose in a closed season. But the moose they allegedly shot at was not real, but rather a decoy set up by the Alaska State Troopers. It was the first decoy to be used to help enforce hunting laws in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. For member station KYUK, Shane Iverson has more.
David Phillip, age 44, and Roman Peter, age 25, are being charged with shooting a moose in the lower Kuskokwim area where a moratorium is in effect. According to troopers, the shooting took place along the Kuskokwim River below the village of Lower Kalskag. The two men were headed downriver. But the moose they allegedly shot was not what it appeared.
It's a moose tar target, an archery target, which is made to look like a moose.
Wildlife trooper Sergeant Paul Randall.
If it's put behind some willows or behind some brush, people will look at it and it looks like a moose.
Randall says the cow moose decoy was set up there because there have been several poaching incidents there in the past. They also timed the decoy with the closure of the fall moose season upriver in Game Unit 19.
There are a lot of upriver campers returning to their homes downriver, a lot of whom had shot moose and some of whom hadn't. And the concern is they're going to see a moose in the moratorium area on the way home and try to take that moose instead.
The decoy was under the surveillance of wildlife troopers. They reported that 83 boats passed by over 3 days, almost all of them headed downriver. Of those boats, 20 stopped to look. Four raised their guns and scoped the decoy, but continued to move on. And then there was the boat containing Philip and Peter.
There was only one boat where they actually shot at it, and those are the people who are charged.
Troopers say that Roman Peter was the one that actually took the shot. He is additionally being charged with shooting game from a moving boat and hunting without a license. Troopers say he shot with a .22 caliber rimfire rifle. That's a low-powered gun used for small game, and it's illegal for shooting a moose. Troopers say the shot was fired as the boat was moving and the two continued to drive on. Randall presented the decoy operation to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Subsistence Advisory Council during their meeting last week. Only one board member spoke against the operation. That was Mary Gregory of Bethel.
I don't like your decoy. It shows unrespect to the people you are serving. Not only are we deprived of getting the meat, but you are being used as an amusement to people who have plenty, who have jobs, who have the means of surviving.
But Greg Rozitska, also of Bethel, said the incident showed that most people are abiding by the moose moratorium. He added that if the troopers' report is true, the acts by Philip and Peter are indefensible.
Those are exactly the kind of people that need to be caught. They weren't trying to catch meat. They just shoot it. They kill it just to kill it. That's totally against everything, all the respect and the teachings of what I've heard around here. It's absolutely disrespectful. These guys were never taught or they never learned.
Sergeant Randall says he knew the decoy enforcement program would be controversial, but he says his job is to enforce the moratorium, which he reminds people was called for by Lower Kuskokwim residents.
It's not something that the state came up with. It's locally supported. Local people decided, look, if we want decent, sustainable harvest of moose, we've got to not shoot them for a few years.
He says he's heard complaints that the decoy setup is a form of entrapment, but that's a charge he disagrees with.
If I place what you think is a moose on a sandbar, you believe it's a moose, knowing it's in a closed area, and you shoot at it, am I forcing you to do anything? No, that's not entrapment. You're attempting to shoot a moose in a closed area.
Randall told the Subsistence Council that if the public was against the measure, troopers would halt the program. But he says most feedback has been positive. They are considering using a decoy in the lower Yukon area in the future. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
This week, more than 600 representatives of Alaska's tourism industry have gathered in Anchorage to learn new ways to attract visitors in a shaky economy. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The Alaska Travel Industry Association convention began with a look at the just-concluded 2008 summer season. ATIA President and Chief Operating Officer Ron Peck prefaced his Tuesday morning appraisal by saying, although the official tally was not complete, in past years these initial figures were within 2 to 3 percentage points of the final ones. During a convention break interview, Peck described the 2008 season total as similar to 2007. The difference was in the details.
The summer season of 2008 will almost be identical in terms of pure numbers, 1,715,000 visitors. The real difference is that we saw a reduction of highway crossings, Alcan travelers, from 75,000 to 60,000, and an increase in overall international visitations, which ultimately resulted in a slight increase in air arrivals from visitors from Europe and from the Pacific Rim.
Peck's review included a perceived change in visitor spending.
In years past, the average expenditure by the visitor, whether they were international or domestic, was right around $935. What we believe may be happening this year, just from anecdotal information from membership, is that folks, for example, traveling domestically on a cruise, were spending less money on the higher-end excursions and the higher gift items, whereas the Germans, the Europeans, the Brits, the Aussies, and the Japanese, because of that devaluation of the dollar, their money was actually going further. So we think that the international visitors were probably spending a little bit more based on what we're hearing from our members.
The Travel Association is enjoying a sizable influx of first-timers, as ATIA calls its new members. The 2008 convention registration shows 20% of the attendees are association newcomers. Peck says the increase is probably due to a pair of factors.
They realize the importance of the industry and this association representing them. And I also think that they're probably thinking, well, I'm going to have to tighten my belt a little bit. And I'm going to have to look at my operating costs and how I'm marketing and maybe get some ideas here about how I can do that and, for lack of a better word, kind of weather the storm.
The workshop topics reflect this summer's demographics and the current economy. One repeated session focuses on the euro's strength and the growing opportunities in the European market. A second reviews the Australian and Japanese markets. Others fall into the internal efficiency category. A couple of team-building workshops, plus direct mail on a budget session, and another on customer loyalty. There are also sessions on Alaska's cultures and environment.
I guess we've matured as an organization where we're stepping beyond marketing.
Kurt Hassel is president of Wildland Adventures and chairs ATIA's Tourism Planning Committee. Hassel says the association will continue its role as the leading organization combining companies large and small to promote Alaska as a visitor destination. But he sees ATIA increasing its emphasis on another portion of its mission, namely remaining attentive to the, quote, care of the environment, recognition of cultures, and Alaska's unique quality of life.
You start talking about the environment or limits, it can be controversial or polarizing, but everybody agrees that our visitors, whether they're a backpacker or a cruise ship visitor, deserves to have a quality experience. And when you think about a quality experience from the wide spectrum of travel companies, you have to work things out with land use sorts of topics.
This is Len Anderson.
A series of incidents in Alaska waters recently has prompted the Coast Guard to step up its campaign to get vessel skippers and owners to report when something goes wrong at sea. Petty Officer Sarah Francis in Anchorage.
Well, it's important that we receive notification of marine casualties so that we can provide oversight of correction of those casualties and maintain a standard of safety in the fleet.
The Coast Guard uses a broader definition of the word casualty than we might be familiar with.
Casualty is a term we use that applies to the failure of machinery, injury or death, loss of a vessel, or damage over a certain amount.
Francis says the Coast Guard has had several delayed reports of marine casualties from a few different vessels lately, which has resulted in the push for skippers and owners to step forward.
For example, we had a case last week with the fishing vessel U.S. Liberator that the master provided notification to his company, but the company didn't get it forwarded on to us in a timely manner. And during the interim, he effected some repairs to his vessel that weren't done correctly. And fortunately, there wasn't any further damage to the vessel or release of product because it was a fuel tank that was damaged. But there's the potential that it could have been much greater.
She says the Coast Guard wants to dispel the perception that just because a skipper reports a marine casualty, that they'll be hauled back to port.
Every case is evaluated separately, and it's a matter of how much risk there is letting the vessel continue to operate. On October 6th, the crew of the Kodiak-based fishing vessel Seabrook reported to us that they'd lost one of their main diesel engines due to a failed coupling, but they had two additional engines that were operational, so we weren't concerned that they would be dead in the water or unable to operate safely. There was sufficient redundancy in their system built in to warrant safe continuation of operations.
Francis says there are fines that range as high as $25,000 associated with failure to report serious mechanical problems.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Alaska Community Foundation, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Your local public radio station has airtimes.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Kusilov musher John Little says a training accident that killed some of his top dogs will not stop him from running the Yukon Quest. Little lost four dogs and had a fifth badly injured late last month when a team being run by a friend pulled onto the Sterling Highway and was struck by a car. Little says he's beginning to get over the accident and is not giving up on the Yukon Quest.
The first week after the accident, I was pretty down. Every run I've gone on since then has sort of helped. And I'm really not negative when it comes to the dogs, and I still have a really good dog team. It's just a lot thinner.
Little says the accident has trimmed his small kennel down to just 20 dogs and that the ones he lost were leaders with race experience. It will be Little's second time running the Quest. He finished a strong fifth in his rookie run in 2005. He's also completed five Iditarods, notching fourth place in his best run in 2002. Little says he loves thousand-mile races and that he's still excited about the Quest despite the devastating accident.
It's going in the same direction as it did in 2005, and I'd like to do a better job. But I'm very enthusiastic about the Quest itself. It's a really wonderful race.
Little says he's talking to other mushers about borrowing or leasing a few dogs for the upcoming race season. He says he'll reassess his racing plan as the winter progresses, but the first event on his schedule is the Sheep Mountain 150 in mid-December. A prominent community elder, whaling captain, and North Slope Borough leader is being remembered for his great contributions to his community. KBRW's Janelle Everett reports.
Family and friends across the North Slope Borough are mourning the loss of Borough Elder Arnold Brower Sr. The whaling captain was reported missing Monday while camping at his family cabin southeast of Borough. The North Slope Borough Search and Rescue and a helicopter being used by Shell Oil initiated a joint search and on Tuesday recovered the whaler's body. Officials believe Brower's snow machine went through the ice, but he managed to pull himself from the water and attempted to walk back to his cabin. Brower's daughter, Maggie Amawak, says her father traveled to his cabin alone each year to participate in his subsistence activities.
He goes up there in the summer and sets it up, and that's his fishing in the river. And when that is done, he makes sure that he meets the caribou migration that goes the first week of August through the middle, and he'll continue to hunt. And when his fall season is done, he also does under the ice fishing to finish his season. And then he would snow machine back when ABC crew will catch a whale, and that was his yearly ritual.
Brower was a decorated World War II veteran who received countless military awards, including a victory medal for his time in the Asian Pacific Theater. Funeral services will be held on Monday at Apollo Elementary School in Borough. Brower and his late wife Emily had 17 children, 80 grandchildren, and over 50 great-grandchildren. On Thursday, the family received a condolence call from Governor Sarah Palin, who was campaigning in Wisconsin. Arnold Brower Sr. was 86 years old. Reporting from Borough, I'm Janelle Everett.
Public radio in Alaska lost a dear friend and colleague last weekend. Steve Will, lately the program director of KCAW in Sitka, died Sunday from injuries he sustained in a bike accident about 6 weeks ago. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has this look at his career in broadcasting.
Steve Will was involved in news and programming at Raven Radio for the better part of two decades, starting out first as a volunteer and then joining the station's staff as a reporter. The apocryphal story told about the Steve Will of those early days is that no one liked him on the radio at first. The tale usually is told to soothe the nerves of new volunteers about to go on the air for the first time. By the time I succeeded him as news director in 2003, Steve Will was what the news sounded like, both in Sitka and around the state. Here's his last broadcast as KCAW's news director.
This is Friday, the 11th of April, 2003. I'm Steve Will with Raven News. Alaska Supreme Court Chief Justice Dana Fabe focused her presentation to the Sitka Chamber of Commerce this week on why it takes
There was
so
never
long
any doubt when Steve Will was reporting cases. That what you were hearing was the real news, no matter how mundane. He was the first reporter in the state to take a hard look at the mounting EPA violations at the Alaska Pulp Corporation mill in Sitka. He also did far-reaching feature stories. One on the lasting effects of sexual abuse of minors won him nationwide honors with the 1992 Ohio State Award, a prize which the following 2 years went to the high-profile public television program Nova. The other running joke involving Steve Will and KCAW is that we were always having goodbye parties for him. He left first to work in a regional news position that would be the precursor to the Coast Alaska Network. He came back and left again to work in print at the Daily Sitka Sentinel. He came back and left again to work as a legal investigator. And he came back one last time in 2006 to work as our program director. Though he did not always work at KCAW, Steve Will remained a potent creative source of programming energy for the station and a steadfast friend and fundraiser. He co-founded the Glorious Youth Parade, Sitka's hottest and most wildly popular 50-something rock band. I remember everything Steve Will taught me about journalism because there were only two things. Put the news at the top, and it's better not to be wrong. Steve Will was 54 years old, though experts believe that prolonged contact with an electric guitar may have altered his physiology by perhaps decades. He is survived by a wife and three lovely daughters. He collided with a vehicle while riding his bike the night of August 29th on Halibut Point Road and never regained consciousness. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Janelle Everett in Barrow, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Tell Alaska, encouraging listeners to tune to AK every weekend. Check your local public radio station for airtimes. Tell Alaska on the web at tellalaska.com. And by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.